You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of March 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show, Guantanamo prisoners with their sights set on the sun and sand of Uruguay must now look elsewhere, with the polls in Montevideo putting pay to the country's asylum program. Then, in the latest development in Vladimir Putin's quest to push the buttons of the world's prime ministers and presidents, Sweden says it has intercepted two Russian bombers and two fighter jets over the Baltic Sea. We'll find out what the Kremlin's got up its sleeve. And later in the show, what's an ambassador's most effective tool? A speech? A diplomatic cable? Or something more along the lines of 140 characters? After America's Woman in Libya signs off a popular social network, we examine the future and perils of public diplomacy. All that, plus a bit of square dancing in China too, coming up right here on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House, and my guests today are regular Monocle contributors Mary Jadesky, columnist for the Independent newspaper in London, and John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay, and North Korea. And your Uruguay skills are going to be tested a little bit later. Well, welcome both to the programme. I thought we'd start today's show by looking at yesterday's big meeting between Greece's new PM, Alexis Tsipras, and the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel. It was Tsipras's first official visit to Berlin. His goal, to resolve differences on economic reforms and win new cash from creditors. So does he have any chance of succeeding? Mary, what did you think of the meeting? I think one of the most striking things was the show almost of unity, of kind of like the bonhomie afterwards. And I'm not sure if that was just for the cameras or if it was, it may have actually been kind of heartfelt, I think.
Well, I thought that was actually almost the most interesting part of it, that there was this sort of idea that everybody was on best behaviour, that all the tensions that had been stored up, that had occasionally come out, all the ill feeling, all those Nazi cartoons in Greece, all those things were being sort of smoothed over by the top two people who were determined to play it like grown-ups and show that there could be some sort of solution. The problem was, so far as I could see, that for all that effort, actually very little came out of it.
John, I think that's a good reading, isn't it? What's intriguing is that all the commentators, all the people who look at the runes after these things are saying nothing really gained by Greece, except perhaps that he gets on with Angela Merkel.
Well, yes. I mean, establishing a relationship with Angela Merkel is worth doing in its own right. But smiles, cuddles, yes. Money, nein. It's quite clear that Angela Merkel has decided that this has got to be played by the book. There are good reasons for this. I mean, quite apart from the huge amounts of money involved with Greece, if the Greeks get let off the hook, then there are others not far behind. But what's becoming more worrying is that it's clear that when the Eurozone and Greece reached this, quote, agreement, unquote, on 20th February, they seem to have quite different views on what was agreed. The Eurozone finance ministers regarded this as just a technical advance and the bailout system basically stands. Greece is talking about a new start, which doesn't seem to exist in anybody's mind apart from that of the Greek government. And this is leading to all kinds of missed conversations and misunderstandings between the Greeks and their creditors. Bad enough at any time, but as Greece is going to run out of money in the next, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, depending on how things play out, this could turn a catastrophe into a crisis.
But what do you think was behind those smiles then? Is it because in the end, you know, they're both playing to domestic audiences in a sense? You know, for the Greeks, it's important to, you know, talk a tough game when you're back in Athens. But actually, when you arrive in Berlin, there's a realization that you've got to play ball and you need to have people on your side to get what you want. And the same, I guess, for Angela Merkel. You know, she has a kind of constituency in Germany who'd be very happy to see Greece go its own way and get rid of them forever, and angered at the kind of war reparations conversation. That's the bit I can't quite understand. What there must be some kind of link between them, some meeting of minds.
Yeah, I think firstly that there are domestic political pressures and domestic political audiences to be satisfied for both Tsipras and Merkel. But I think it's important not to lose sight of the human dimension to this. We have two people, both under immense stress, with a very, very difficult situation. And I think simply, that they decided that they were not going to let this get personal. There were all kinds of very tricky technical issues involved, but that they both, I think, came out saying they regretted some of the rhetoric that had preceded that meeting. And they are, trying to at least deal with this in a more or less civilized way. You mentioned reparations. Can I just add a footnote to that? I don't think Greece is going to get anywhere on reparations. But it's emerged over the last few days that in 1941-42, that Nazi Germany forced Greece to lend it money, to pay, in fact, for Hitler's Africa campaign. And this forced loan had payback terms with an automatic interest uplift clause in it. They've run the numbers, and it looks as if Germany does owe Greece about 11 billion euros, which would come in very handy just now. Thank you.
Well, it'd be slightly strange having to kind of thank the governments of 1940s for that. Angela Merkel, she comes out of this very well, I think. Don't you think that, she could have been angered by the comparisons that have been made between the Nazis and herself. Tsipras certainly tried to tone that down, but don't you think she comes out of this as she's not flustered, she's not angered, she's charming, but she does not budge from her course, Mary?
I think that Angela Merkel has two immense qualities. One of them seems to be almost limitless patience. And the other is an extremely equable temperament that she doesn't get rattled. And sometimes she's criticised for this, especially in Germany and sometimes in the EU. People say, oh, well, she did this. She doesn't decide things till the last moment. But actually, I think in current circumstances, there's actually quite a good argument for sitting back, waiting to see. And she's been very good at that. And I think her judgment as to when to move has been impeccable, not just on the Greek issue, but on almost everything else.
I was going to say, especially on, it strikes me with the issue with Russia, and we'll come on to the Russians later in the show. She was, loyal. And then when pushed too far, then she kind of changes her course, but then she's stern again. It's going to be very hard for the Russians to budge her back. Don't you think, again, John, this is the sign of a proper statesperson? That you look across the European canvas, and is there anyone up to her mark?
No. I think Angela Merkel stands head and shoulders above all the others. She's calm, she's collected, she thinks very, very systematically, she plans, she strategizes, and she doesn't make off-the-cuff remarks, which, as we know in the UK, have got a certain political cost to them. I think she's an extraordinary leader. I think Germany is very fortunate to have her, particularly at this very difficult moment.
I think there's just one footnote to add to that, that I think normally it's very easy to say that each person in such extreme circumstances are playing to their domestic audience. And I think there was a sense in which actually each player yesterday was playing to the other person's domestic audience, and that they appreciated that and they wanted to be seen somehow differently from the stereotype they'd been seen as before.
Yeah. Very good. Well, we're going to move on now, and we're going to go to Uruguay. Back in December, six former prisoners from the US detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, held there for a dozen years, received sanctuary in Uruguay. Yet now the government in Montevideo says it will no longer grant asylum to them, nor to refugees from the war in Syria. It seems a program launched by outgoing President Jose Mujica didn't exactly go down well with the locals. Cultural and infrastructure problems have also been blamed. John, you were ambassador in Uruguay. And so first of all, we should say that Jose Mujica was an extraordinary man, a man who was famous for kind of travelling around, I think, by a very modest beetle car. Was it a beetle or a panda?
It was a beetle.
Beetle. Yeah. And very reformist about drugs policy and everything you can think of. And he put out the welcoming mat for these men. But even he has said it's a struggle. They don't speak Spanish. There's cultural issues. Do you think it was a plan just didn't go well, or do you think that actually, as we hinted there, that there's a kind of deeper unease in Uruguay?
I think it was a plan that didn't go well, that Mujica, remember, who spent many, many years detained as a political prisoner under Uruguay's military regime, felt for these people. I mean, this was an act of the heart, and he wanted to do something for them. So he finds space in Uruguay for 6 prisoners. But politics, humanitarian acts apart, there is a practical dimension to this. These people are very badly damaged, damaged by their experiences probably before they came to Guantanamo, and certainly by what happened to them there. Add that to an inability to speak Spanish, as Mujica said, and you get some very difficult situations. There's been domestic violence, there's been a fracas associated with some of these people. Now, in any society, you get a reaction to that. Uruguay is a particularly conservative society. People are quiet, reserved, and mind their own business. And discovering that these people who've been brought in from Guantanamo, you know, in the house next door or wherever it might be, are fighting each other, are causing noise, really goes down very badly in Uruguay and went right across the Uruguayan media. I think the incoming government's hand has simply been forced. The reaction against such transfers was so strong that they had no choice but to say, OK, we're not going to do any more, at least until the end of this year.
Mary, it's all very well and good a country saying, OK, we're going to change our mind about this. But there's a real issue here, isn't there? We have more prisoners who need to come out of Guantanamo Bay at some point. Nobody very keen to take them. But many of these people haven't even been tried. You know, we don't know whether they're guilty of any crime. What can be done? How do we bring together some kind of court of public opinion that gives these people a chance?
Well, it is extremely, extremely difficult because this particular limited contingent who went to Uruguay was seen as a sort of solution to a totally intractable problem, that people who'd been holed up in Guantanamo, justly, unjustly, the question of extraterritoriality, judicial extraterritoriality in America, which was completely anti-constitutional. Yet what were they going to do when they came out? Were they going to be in Guantanamo forever? What would happen if, as Obama has always wanted to do, Guantanamo were closed? Where were they going to go? Because what, of course, has not been said so far in this conversation is that the countries these prisoners originally came from have disowned them. They don't want them back. Now, they don't want them back because they know they're damaged. They don't want them back because they're tarnished by however they got, or whatever the reason for them going to Guantanamo in the first place was. So they're essentially homeless, stateless, and they're looking for almost the last place that will take them. And if Uruguay says no, then it's very hard to see where else they can go.
John, the broadening of this, you know, this action to say, okay, we won't take refugees from Syria either. We're going to put that all on hold. The strange thing is that, you know, Syrians have been migrants for centuries. When you go to any city in Latin America, you find Syrian communities, you find Lebanese communities. They've been very good at absorbing people from every part of the world, but certainly from the Arab world. Is there something else going on here? Is there just part of this general reaction we see across Europe that people are putting up their borders a bit? Is that even happening in Latin America?
Yes, I think it is. I think the reaction against immigration that has been headline news in Europe for so long is also affecting Latin American politics. Uruguay, in Latin American terms, is a relatively wealthy country and has constant issues with illegal migrants from places like Bolivia and sometimes from Ecuador as well. So, you know, the basic political situation for migrants is not great. I think, nevertheless, that a lot of Uruguayans were prepared to give these people the benefit of the doubt when they first arrived. But then, as I said, these stories came out and kept coming out about very disruptive behaviour by these people. And I think the government assumes that if it brings in people from Syria, that we're going to get the same. The population are simply not going to take it.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck. John and Mary are going to be staying with us and we'll be here when we return. Up next, Putin's latest provocation, the digital limits of public diplomacy and square dancing in Beijing.
From the streets of Kabul to a girls' school in the shadow of the Hindu Kush, London-based artist George Butler spent 3 weeks in Afghanistan, reporting on life in the war-torn country through that most old-fashioned of methods, paper and ink.
This is in Herat, and as always, I just picked a spot that I thought I could describe what I was witnessing as best as I could. It's very much that balance in Afghanistan of how long it's safe to be there, but also that drive to try and describe to people what it's like in a place that is almost always described as dangerous or unsafe.
Art of War, a Monocle film, now playing on Monocle.com.
Our first Monocle Quality of Life conference is taking place in Lisbon, Portugal, from Friday the 17th to Sunday the 19th of April. Over 3 days and with the help of 20 speakers, we're going to reveal the best projects, people and practices helping to create dynamic cities around the globe. Guest speakers include the legendary typographer Eric Spiekerman, celebrated architect Bjarke Ingels, and the V&A's director Martin Roth. This is an intimate weekend, and we know that important conversations will continue long after the speakers have left the stage. So we'll make sure there's plenty of opportunities to talk at the receptions, at the final night's dinner, and beyond. The Monocle Quality of Life Conference in Lisbon, Portugal, from the 17th to the 19th of April. Find out more at conference.monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is John Everard, former British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea, and Mary Dzhejevsky, columnist for the Independent newspaper here in London. To Russia now, where the Kremlin has given us yet another example of muscle flexing and slight provocation. In the past few months alone, we've seen Russian submarines near the coast of Sweden and a convoy of Russian warships dispatched to Australia's northern border. Well, now it seems Sweden has intercepted 4 Russian planes, 2 Russian backfire bombers escorted by 2 flanker fighter jets flying over the Baltic with their tracking turned off. Mary, Sweden's not a member of NATO. Is this a worrying development, do you think?
Well, I think Sweden has always actually been quite easy and tempting prey for Russians. I mean, time was when the spectacular episode of the Russian submarine caught in the Stockholm archipelago. These things happen. They happened during the Cold War. And I suppose what's disturbing about it now is that, you know, this is not the Cold War. This is post-Soviet Russia. And the idea that exactly the same tactics are being used, the sort of pressure putting, the sort of flying very close to borders but remaining in international airspace, turning off the transponders, all those sort of techniques are being used and look awfully threatening and intimidating. I think in some ways that's, as it were, that's really to be too alarmist about it. I think so far, everybody has actually observed the technicalities. Nobody, so far that I'm aware, has actually transgressed beyond international airspace. They've been flying very, very close, but they've not gone over. And of course, what we don't know, we're only getting half of this story, because when tensions run high over other things, then, as it were, our side, the NATO side, the Western side, decides to publicise these incidents. Under normal circumstances, very similar things happen. These are regular occurrences. The difference is that in calmer times, people simply take them as normality and they're not publicised.
And I think it's fair to say that I think these planes were also in international airspace. They hadn't crossed into Swedish airspace. John, Mr. Putin's just having some fun, isn't he?
I think it's more than fun. I think he's doing two things. Firstly, he is using Sweden, as Russia so often has, to train air crews and penetration techniques. I mean, in the same way as he uses Swedish waters to teach his submarine crews how to dodge interception. And he's probing defences. He's seeing what happens. I think It's important, yes, as you say, to note that everybody stayed in international airspace. You are not supposed to fly around international airspace with your transponder off. That is a breach of international regulations. And, you know, at some point, I hope the Russians will be brought to book over this. There's another point to all this that I think is getting lost in the noise here. These were backfire bombers. The backfire bomber entered service in 1972. It's the kind of aircraft which most Western air forces would have put into a museum long ago. They were intercepted by Gripen fighters. Fast, sleek, they could outrun anything that the Russians had sent up. I can't help thinking that if Putin is trying to show off, he's doing it in a very strange way. You know, and what the crews of these lumbering ancient bombers must have thought as these super sleek Swedish fighters whiz past them, heaven only knows.
The other strange thing is, isn't it just kind of backfires in another sense, in that, you know, when you come here to the UK, you know, defence ministers saying, OK, we need to up our spending, the same conversation happening in capitals all around Europe. You know, he's sending out a few planes, you know, maybe testing a few kind of defence systems, but he's just making sure that all these defence budgets are shorn up.
Well, yes, a backfire in a big way, as you rightly say. And as Western defence spending rises, and I think it will, I mean, we haven't actually seen that happen yet, but the indications are quite clear, Russia is not going to be able to match that. Russia has, for the past several years, been massively increasing its defence spend, but it is nowhere near the levels that it wants to be, to be credible if, heaven forfend, it ever came to a showdown with the West. I think it's important to remember that in the Cold War, very roughly, there was a trade-off between Western technology and Soviet numbers. The Soviet armed forces in numbers were considerably greater than those of NATO, but NATO had all the smart kit. Now, NATO has the smart kit and four times as many troops as Russia.
To take a very parochial view, this is an absolute godsend in a way for the British Armed Forces, because there's a huge row going on before the election in the UK about the level of defence spending. And this gives the armed forces exactly the sort of ammunition that they would love to have to argue for more money.
Absolutely.
Well, we're going to move on now. Let's look now at a case of public diplomacy gone horribly wrong. After receiving what she calls vulgar personal attacks, America's ambassador to Libya has decided to quit Twitter. Deborah Jones came under attack after posting what appears to be a possibly erroneous account of an airstrike in the country, in which she said 8 civilians had been killed. Others have disputed that detail, saying that no one was killed. Jones, who's been based in Malta since the security situation in Libya worsened this past summer, has said that she's taken a hiatus from the social network. Mary, I guess there's a kind of a charge always to kind of have an opinion, get out there, and she's fallen foul.
Yes. I've always had a large question in my mind about the wisdom of especially diplomats using Twitter. I understand that, you know, it's an incredibly attractive, immediate medium. It reaches a wide audience. It makes you look as though you're being incredibly modern and you're talking to the world. And if you're a diplomat, you're talking not just to your fellow diplomats, but you hope to the people of the country that normally you wouldn't be able to reach. And all this is hugely attractive. But we've seen so many times with politicians and with diplomats, you cross the line and you're in trouble way beyond what the remarks that you made immediately on your mobile phone actually meant. And undoing the damage is colossally complicated. So I think maybe there ought to be some sort of delaying tactic on diplomatic mobile phones that give them sort of 10 minutes to think about it before they fire anything off.
John, you know, the nature of diplomacy should be consideration, nuance, deep thoughts, and trying to get that all down to 140 characters. You're setting yourself up for failure, aren't you?
Yes, you are. I agree entirely with Mary. I think that the day that diplomats started tweeting was a bad day. It's caused far more damage than any benefit that we might have seen from it. It also takes up a lot of time, and it is distracting. You know, if you are thinking not just about what is the right policy for my government in the situation, but also how am I going to tweet this, you know, it's not a sensible use of high-powered brain power.
Don't you think also, I always, it strikes me, it brings in this notion of being liked and that you're doing the appealing thing. Whereas often, I think in diplomacy, you've got to do tough and difficult things and say things that aren't very comfortable. But they're judging their success by, in a way, the number of retweets, the number of people who kind of like what they have to say. And here's an instance where, you know, if she just kept quiet, it would have been so much better. Mary.
Yes, I mean, I think that there is so much difficulty with that particular aspect of the social media that in some ways it's so easy, and yet the comments, you know, you were talking about 140 characters. I mean, things are facile. They're simplistic. They reduce things to the lowest common denominator. They're not, you know, it's not necessarily just what diplomats shouldn't be doing, but what a whole lot of other professionals shouldn't be doing, because it casts them in a light that actually undermines any authority that they might need to have as part of their job.
Now, we have to save time for a rather glorious final story. We're going to head, as it were, to China now. This is a story about dancing, because it's just become political in China. Old women dancing to loud music at night seems to be causing problems in the country. So the government's response has been to regulate the dancing, to approve only a dozen square dances as the national standard. John, we should explain. So it turns out they're called dammers or dhammas, and these old ladies gather on street corners and play very loud music. I don't know what their kids are doing. They're kind of stuck at home while their grannies are out having all the fun. And they've become so bad in some cities, I understand, that all sorts of unpleasant things have been thrown at them from windows.
Well, that's right. I've seen this often in China. They're fairly fearsome elderly ladies. You do not want to mess with these people. But they do turn their ghetto blasters up really loud. And some of the music they dance to is slightly strange. So there have been lots of complaints. In some places, there have been local kind of arrangements between the ladies who dance and others so about how loud you can have your ghetto blasters. In one city, they have police patrols every half hour to make sure that the volume is at the right setting. So the lucky ladies not only get to dance, they get hunky policemen hovering around all the time. I mean, how good can life get?
Are they good at dancing? I mean, do they actually make a decent show of it?
Standards vary, actually, Mary. I wouldn't want to talk it up. Some of them are actually quite good. A lot will tend to throw the limbs around a bit.
What I liked is one of the officials said that, you know, he recognised that line dancing went to the heart of Chinese culture. Is that true? I thought it was American culture.
Well, that's right. And it's curious that the official reaction to this, the reaction, incidentally, by a department called the Department for Mass Fitness. I mean, only in China do you get these organisations. Anyway, the Department for Mass Fitness has, as you say, suggested 12 scientifically proven dances that will keep you nice and fit, so you don't have to go square dancing. Point one, square dancing is, of course, an American dance. Perish the thought that this was any part of the Chinese decision. Point two, giving the elderly ladies a different dance doesn't do anything about the volume at which they're going to play their ghetto blasters. You're going to be annoying people doing different dances, that's all.
Do we know why they've just chosen these 12 dances? Or were the others too salacious? I don't know.
Oh, yes, one wonders, doesn't one? I suspect it was because they felt they had to react in some way, but no way was the Department of Mass Fitness going to take on the massed grey ranks of elderly ladies in China.
Well, they're going to have to take a leaf out of London's book with the busking qualification, that if you want to busk on the London Underground, then you have basically to be vetted for the standards of your singing or playing by a committee from the mayor's office. So maybe Chinese cities are going to have to do that.
Mary, have you been known to do-si-do of an evening?
Absolutely not. And I was so bad at our equivalent of line dancing, which is country dancing at school. It was positively embarrassing.
John, are you a hoedown man? Do you have a check shirt in your wardrobe?
I have been banned from the dance floor by my poor, crushed-footed wife.
Oh, well, I think the two of you could go for some practice and we can pick up the story next week. But we're going to have to leave it there. That was Mary Jajewski and John Everard. And thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. And that's all we have time for. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Mark Hewin, and it was also run by our studio manager, Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Marcus Hippie is going to be bringing you lots of music from our international playlist. Then at 1900 hours, it's Section D. And at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. If I can get my words out. But from me, Andrew Tuck, it's just time to say thank you very much for listening and have a good evening. Bye-bye.